walking down the pouring rain. Got no home, got no one to call. Yeah, my back's up to the wall. Walking down the streets of shade, people passing, my name they don't know. How I feel inside, say much.
This is the Guy James Show.
The world is getting older. There's a few things to be said. Do you believe the things they told you? Do you believe the things you've read?
The Guy James Show, America's number one Democratic talk show. You've heard from the radical right. Now, all that's left is the truth. And now here's Guy James.
Welcome. Welcome back to the Guy James Show. Here we are on a, what is this, Wednesday? Tend to lose track of what day it is. Anyway, so glad to have you all along with us this afternoon. My goodness, we've got the studio window. Well, the shade's open today anyway. Don't have the actual window open. Looking outside at a glorious Florida afternoon. Probably around 90 degrees outside, maybe not quite 90, and not a cloud in the sky. Beautiful, beautiful day here in Southwest Florida, and I hope it's a gorgeous day. here in a tropical climate. Now, I'm originally from Ohio, Midwest. You've heard me say that many, many times. But there's certain times of the year that you... a progressive strategy for Iraq and getting the hell out of there. It's going to be an interesting discussion, and we hope you'll join in. We'd love to have you call us today, 866-546-5254. Always good to have you join in on the discussion, get your 2 cents worth, and even 3 cents. We'll allow you more than 3 cents worth. So that's the deal. Call us today. We hope you will. 866-546-5254. And, you know, we celebrated, what was it, yesterday or the day before, the three-year anniversary of the mission accomplished. And, the more I think about that, and I have been thinking about it, 3 long years this war has been going on now. I always try and put everything in some sort of a historical context. That's kind of my game. I love history. I'm a student of history, and it's something that, I don't know, just always been interesting to me. But I try and compare this, taking a look back at other wars we've had. 3 years after the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor was December 7th, 1944, 3 years afterwards. And by that time, and I'm just trying to paint a picture here for you as to what happened then and what happened now, comparing something that happened, 62 years ago. And here we are 62 years later with all the modern technology and facilities that we have in this country now. I want to kind of draw you a comparison of how the nation mobilized then and how the Bush administration has been able to mobilize things now. And that's what I want to talk about just for a few minutes. 3 years after December 7th, 1941, most of the Japanese Navy was on the bottom of the sea 3 years afterward. There were waves and waves of bombers that were turning Japan's major cities into rubble, with the exception of Nagasaki and Hiroshima, which they had other plans for. And the United States had floated over 40 aircraft carriers, thousands of other warships and cargo ships, built hundreds of thousands of tanks and aircraft, and equipped tens of millions of soldiers in order to defeat and occupy major threats to America, Germany, and Japan. And a pre-war army, which was right around 300,000, had been built into an army of over 20 million. And those 20 million were charged with defeating and occupying the enemy nations of Germany and Japan. And there were hundreds of thousands of Japanese and German-speaking Americans that had been drafted as interpreters and translators or to train other Americans on how to speak Japanese or German. And the plan for occupation of Japan and Germany were well underway. Yes, they had a plan for occupying those countries. Taxes had been raised in order to pay for the war. And the majority of Americans of working age were either in the military or in some sort of war-related industry supporting the military and its goal of total defeat of the enemies of the nation. So put that... let's draw a comparison to today of what I've just told you. 3 years after George W. Bush proclaimed mission accomplished on the deck of the USS Abraham Lincoln, our soldiers in Iraq still don't have adequate equipment. The majority of American units in Iraq still do not have Arabic-speaking interpreters. And the NSA and the CIA still don't have enough Arabic-speaking translators to properly handle the masses of intelligence they receive about the movements of people who want to do harm to America. And rather than millions of boots on the ground, such as during the initial occupations of Germany and Japan, there's maybe only 40,000 boots. The rest over there are support troops and in heavily fortified bases. And rather than raise taxes to pay for the war, Bush cut taxes for the rich, thereby selling our nation to the Chinese, who are in the process of bankrupting our country. We all know that. And rather than building mighty war industries, Bush has accelerated the process of shipping critical industrial infrastructure overseas, a process that most certainly started during the presidency of St. Ronald of Reagan, but reached an exponential curve today. And rather than defending our borders... Our borders are a total mess with millions of illegal immigrants crossing it every year. So many illegal immigrants that any terrorist who wished to cross it could easily merge with the herd and be almost impossible to stop them. But yesterday, I paid $3.09 a gallon to fill up my gas tank. Yes, sirree, mission accomplished. And if you're an oil company in pursuit of record profits, old Vice President Halliburton rubs his hands together and just smiles with glee every time you or I take it up the rear at the pump. Mission accomplished. Yes, sirree, mission accomplished. Oh, boy. I think right now this war maybe has lasted as long as the Korean War. And I don't see any end in sight. Any of you see any end in sight in this war right now? I don't know. Doesn't look good to me. And all this flap over the national anthem. Come on. Please. Are you tired of that? I guess, here we go again, then pulling out the patriotism card, if you will. The people on the right are all very patriotic, you know. They all are, not all anymore. But those of them, those, and they know who they are, and they should hang their heads in shame right now. Everybody that was all gung-ho for going to Iraq and just kicking those Iraqis' asses, you know, like everybody wanted to do, they should all hang their heads in shame right now. They really should. I spoke to my good friend Bob Kincaid the other day, and he's been spending a little bit of time in Alabama. And, you know, it's a hardcore red state. And he said, you know, the folks there just aren't wanting to talk too much about Mr. Bush anymore. And have you noticed you're not seeing very many of those stickers on the cars anymore? And like I mentioned yesterday, if you do see one that says Bush Cheney 04, if you see one of those stickers on the car, you stay the hell away from those people. They probably got a shotgun in there. They're dangerous or they're crazy or both. And when you stop and think about that, you would have to be half nuts to have one of those on your car nowadays, wouldn't you? You'd just be begging for some sort of confrontation. That's why I say if you do run into those kinds of people, stay away from them because they're most likely very dangerous or crazy, and you don't want to end up in a situation like that. Or maybe they're incredibly lazy. They just forgot that sticker's on the back of their car. Can you imagine all my friends on the left and all my progressive and Democrat, can you imagine driving a car around with a sticker on it today that says Bush Cheney on it? Ooh. Man, I'd be so embarrassed. I'm not kidding. If I was going to carpool it with somebody to go to a meeting or a speaking engagement or something, and they said they would drive, and they pulled it, well, none of my friends did, but anyway, if it did happen, they said, here, we'll give you a ride, and I saw a Bush Cheney sticker on the back, I would not get in the car. I would not want to be, I'd have to put a bag over my head or something. Oh, now, come on. I know a couple of you out there said he needs a bag over his head anyway. The old face for radio joke. But anyway, stay away. So what I was starting to talk about, I get sidetracked so easily, don't I? I guess you've noticed that by now. All this flap about the national anthem and all these very patriotic Americans. Isn't it amazing how they come out of the woodwork? You know, that's how I got sidetracked. We're talking about how patriotic they were when we went to war with Iraq, how they all had their cars decorated with just all those little flags and all those little bows, you know, those little plastic bows on the back, and support our troops and pray for President Bush and all that crap. Had all that stuff all over the car because everyone knows, and it's a proven fact, that the more of that stuff you've got on the car, the better American you are. I mean, everybody knows that. And so, after all the shame and humiliation of finding out that the fearless leader is a liar and a fraud and the most corrupt president in American history with the most corrupt administration in history, these people are getting all patriotic again on us all of a sudden because of the immigration issue. Now, as I have mentioned, I'm one of those people that I don't know about gray. I'm either black or white on issues, but I haven't come to a definitive conclusion of what I would do if I were king of the world about the immigration issue. And I'll let you know some of these days what I've decided. Not that they'll follow my suggestion. Probably ought to, but they won't. Anyway, here we are with all these people out of the woodwork again. And just so indignant. So indignant that anybody would sing the national anthem in Espanol. Frankly, I consider myself just as American as the next guy. I love my country just as much as the next guy. I don't have to stand out in the middle of the road and wave a flag to love my country. I believe those people are a bit silly. I think the way you really love your country is to work and do what's right for it, not get out and wave a flag when some cause comes along. I think to be a real American, you have to live it. You have to live it every day. And to be a real American, you work for what's right. You work for, in America, you work for what's good for all of the people. You work for justice. You work for equality for all people. That's being a real American. Personally, I've known some real assholes that get the flag out and just go out and wave it around and say, look at me, I'm just Mr. Uncle Sam himself. Well, I don't like people like that. I never did. I've never been like that, and hope to God I never do get like that. But anyway, here they come. Here they are again. Well, you're not going to sing my national anthem in Espanol. No, sir, you're not going to. Those damn immigrants out there singing my national anthem in Spanish. Why, that's horrible. You know what? They'll stone me for saying this. I don't care if you sing it in Portuguese. I don't care if you sing it in French, Spanish, whatever. It doesn't matter to me. So long as you sing it with love in your heart for this country and for what that flag stands for. Yes, sir, that's what it means to me. But the reason I brought all this up, and you knew I was going somewhere with it, I usually do. Just the other day, Junior Bush was asked what he thought about the national anthem being sung in Spanish. And his comment was, and I quote him exactly, "I think the national anthem ought to be sung in English." All right, that's what the man said. "I think the national anthem ought to be sung in English." Well, as luck would have it, and we always do have this kind of luck when it comes to Junior Bush, we find out that while he was campaigning for his first term, he, Junior Bush himself, would often sing the national anthem in Spanish. Yes, sir. Kevin Phillip, on page 142 of his book, American Dynasty, documents that Bush did just that, because Kevin traveled around with him on that campaign. He was trying to woo the Spanish vote, if you'll remember. And you remember he got up and spoke in Espanol to many, many crowds when he would go out and speak. But you see, now that he's not running for office, that's a dirty, rotten thing to do. The hypocrisy of these people just overwhelms me. I'm suffering of some sort of a Republican hypocrisy overload. I really am. I sit down every day and I think, what am I going to talk about on the show today? And the subjects, you know, they just come out of the work and I go, oh no, not another one. Oh no, not another shenanigan that they've pulled. It and another, you know, terrible hypocritical statement they do. But you know, here he is saying it's got to be sung in English, and then we find out he was singing it in Espanol lots of times back when he was running for office, along with speaking his mangled Spanish. And I'm not going to complain about his Spanish. I don't speak very good Spanish myself. I'm trying to learn, but I'm not doing so well. Yes, I am trying to learn to speak Spanish. So there. I live amongst many wonderful Spanish people, and some of them speak English about the way I speak Spanish, and so we're even. They're trying to learn to speak English, and I'm trying to learn to speak Spanish, and we're communicating somehow. And I love the people. I love them. Let me get that straight. I love the Spanish people I live around, and you'll never hear me say an unkind word about them. And I hate the fact that people do. Hate it. I am not the world's authority on societal issues, on cultural issues, but I'll tell you this. I doubt there are many cultures on this planet that have a better work ethic or better family values than the wonderful Spanish people I know in this area. Hard-working, family-loving people. You see them out with their kids. You always see the whole family together. It's a wonderful sight. And the rest of you that don't like that, why the hell with you? I don't really care what you think. I really don't. I love these people. And there's a tremendous number of them here. And I'm from a place where there weren't any Hispanic or Latino people. And so it would have been natural for me to move to this area and be apprehensive about them. But I never was, because I learned right away that they're wonderful people. And you have, of course, some people point out, oh, look at the crime of some of these gangs. There's just as much white crime as there is Mexican, Honduran, and Nicaraguan crime. No more, no less. What about the gangs? What about the Spanish gangs you see in these prisons? Oh, really? What about the White Aryan Brotherhood gangs you see in these prisons? Am I proud of my race? Yes, I am. I suppose the way to look at it is I'm probably pretty doggone lucky to have been born a white American, because we have been privileged. And a lot of the other people on earth have not been so lucky and so privileged as we have. Do I consider myself any better than any other race, any other culture on earth? Certainly not. I hope I'm not just being naive. I know I'm not just being naive by saying that. I live that, so that's the way it is. So I'm way off the subject, but I was speaking to another political junkie today, and he mentioned to me that the fact that Bush said that wasn't, you know, he said that the fact that Bush said that about it ought to be said in English, that wasn't important at all, that we Democrats, we liberals, we nitpick, and we just jump on every little thing he does now. I beg to differ. This issue, albeit very minor on its own, and it is, it's a minor issue, it's just one more demonstration that any time Bush opens his mouth in any sort of unscripted response to a question from the press, the response he provides is always either incorrect, hypocritical, or a bold-faced lie. In that context, the fact that Bush frequently sang the national anthem in Spanish is important, because it's just yet one more indication that he has no credibility whatsoever. He never did. And I think we need to point out every single time he does this, no matter how minute, no matter how insignificant it may seem, because his so-called credibility is what got him elected or selected. And I don't care how you cut it. The lower his numbers go, the better chance the Democrats have of taking back the Senate and maybe even the House as well. Let's face it. And as you know, I always face the fact that the Republicans don't have the market cornered on lying. But I've got to tell you, they have certainly got it down to a fine art. In fact, about political lies in the past couple of decades, their lying compared to the Democrats' lying is like, it's like comparing a painting by Michelangelo as compared to one by Andy Warhol. Maybe that's a lousy. Anyway, the Republicans have mastered the art of lying and prevaricating, and most especially, they've brought political corruption to a level never before dreamed of. I know the Democrats are a bunch of rookies compared to these guys with lying and corruption. And they've done their share. You take Tom DeLay's little escapade on K Street, for example. I think it was called the K Street Project. Imagine this. DeLay actually had the stones to go to the big lobbying firms and tell them, and he didn't ask them, he told them that they dare not hire any Democrats or he'd deny them access to Republican politicians. Now, that, that took some real balls. And ladies, I'm sorry, it took some nerve, okay? And then we find out that several of DeLay's aides are up to their ears in corruption linked to Abramoff, and DeLay claims he knows nothing about that. Tom DeLay, this man, the man they called the Hammer, the name that he just relished in, he was so damn proud of it. This man didn't know the every move of his political aides and confidants in his office? Oh, man, if you believe that, please come and see me about some waterfront property I got for sale in Needles, California. I mean, please. I think it was, who was it, Albert Einstein? I'm pretty sure it was Albert Einstein, said two things are infinite, the human, the universe and human stupidity, and I'm not sure about the universe. that involves anybody who still believes in this stuff that the Hammer and all of his boys and all the whole Abramoff crew and Cheney and Bush, they're all just a bunch of saints. And it says poor old Democrats just picking on them every day. That's making them look bad. God, how can we be so anti-American picking on the president every day the way we do? He just doesn't deserve a fate like this. He's a good, godly Christian man, and those Democrats are just running him in the ground day after day. Those un-American bastards, how can they do that? Oh, my. We are a terrible lot, are we not? We Democrats, we liberals, we progressives. To run down this good Christian godly man. So, yes, as I spoke yesterday, I'm going to try not to get involved in the minutiae every day of all the new scandals coming out because it literally is impossible to keep up with the scandal and corruption in this administration. I think the newspapers would have to assign a new reporting team and a new investigative team every day to a new story coming out every day out of Washington. I doubt there are enough reporters in Washington to keep track of all the stories of corruption coming out, and you've by no means seen the end of them. And although it's being denied, it does bring up kind of a local story, and I don't want to mention any names, of course. But, you know, a former very local politician here that lived maybe a mile and a half or two as the crow flies from where I'm sitting right now at the TIB studios, lived on an island here, had a very nice mansion out there, and a Republican politician, and the word is all over Washington that Duke Cunningham was sending limos to pick him up as well as some other Republican fellas to meet with prostitutes over at the Watergate complex. Wouldn't it be just all too sweet? Wouldn't the karma just be amazing if it ended up that Watergate ended up being the scene of another monstrous Republican corruption scandal? Wouldn't that just be something too interesting, I think, just too interesting. You ever been by Watergate? I drove by it, a couple years ago? Had a notion to go in. I wanted to go in and see where the office was that got broken in. I just like these historic things, like to find out where it happened. But it's just a big old ugly-looking complex. I think Monica Lewinsky and her mother lived there, as I recall. I'm not sure. So there's lots of things that take place over there at Watergate. Hey, let's take a moment and go to the phone here before the bottom of the hour. Hello, Well, let's do this. Push the button. We're trying to get him on the air. Oh, here we go. Hello, you're on the air.
Yeah.
Hello.
This is Alice.
Hi, Alice.
Guy?
Yes.
The right-wing radio talkers are still twisting everything and still trying to sell us on these guys.
Well.
And their stations are all over the place, and I guess some people are still buying it. You really say it loud and clear.
Well, they own most of the radio stations, and as you know, there's a big company called Clear Channel that kind of controls the media in this country, radio anyway. And, you know, Alice, no matter what you're selling, there's going to be somebody going to buy it. And thankfully, there's fewer people buying their line than there was. I guess we got that in our favor, don't we?
Yeah, that's right. I think we've made some headway.
We certainly have. Pointed out that perhaps these fellows just weren't quite as honest and forthright as a lot of people thought they were.
Yeah. Oh, I really have enjoyed your speech.
Well,
I've laughed.
Well, thank you. You know, you can't help but laugh at some of it. Some of it's so...
Well, I know.
It's so preposterous. Some of it is just plain funny.
You know, they've just been lying all the time, so... but we got to do something about it.
Well, it's that old saying, how do you tell when, and you can apply it to Bush, how do you know when he's lying? Well, whenever his lips are moving. I mean, that's just basically it. Him and Cheney both and DeLay and the whole gang of them.
Well, we're getting a little action.
I think so. Oh, and I think things are starting to turn. I don't want to talk about it every day, but I do think it's important to bring up the lying and the hypocrisy to at least try to do the best we can to convince some of the people that might be impressionable on the other side, that might listen to reason, that this man has lied to them, and maybe they'll change the way they think about politics from now on.
You know what I worry about the young people today, what they'll be facing.
Well, that's...
It's upsetting.
It is. It is upsetting. They're going to end up paying the bill.
Pardon?
They're going to be stuck with the bill for this war.
I know it. And how are they going to pay it?
I don't know. Someday, you always have to pay the piper, and the piper's going to come a-calling some of these days. And
they won't have very good memories of us.
Yeah.
Why we let it happen.
That's right. We just didn't work on, hard enough to keep it from happening.
Well, Guy, just keep fighting every inch.
Well, we will.
You have to.
Thanks for calling.
Yeah, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Hey, we're going to take a quick break right now. We're going to get a hold of our first guest and probably have him on when we get back. Let's take a break right now. And we're back, as promised, and glad to have all of you with us this afternoon. And as we promised you earlier before we went to break, we're going to have an expert with us today to talk about the oil crisis, the gasoline crisis, something that's been hurting everybody every time you pull up to a gas station. Today we've got James Paul with us. James is the executive director of the Global Policy Forum. He knows a lot about the subject. He's written several pieces about oil, including oil in Iraq, the heart of the crisis, and his group also co-published the study Crude Designs the Ripoff of Iraq's Oil Wealth. James Paul, glad to have you with us this afternoon.
Oh, very nice to be with you.
As you know, we're going to discuss a subject that's dear to all of our hearts right now, especially when we pull up to the pump. I know I certainly am watching my consumption now, probably more than I ever did, and I think a lot of people are. Those little extra trips that they make, you're cutting down on them, and hopefully the conservation will help a little bit. But where are we today on these gas prices? First of all, the question that comes to mind with the average citizen is this just plain old price gouging that's going on right now?
Well, I really don't think it's good to analyze it in those terms, actually, because there is a shortage, and the shortage is not due to a conspiracy by companies or by foreign governments or anything. It's just that it looks like we're running out of this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And the more, and at the same time, global demand is rising. China's economy is growing very fast. There's a lot of Chinese want to have an automobile now. China's also using trucks for transportation of goods. India's got a very big economy, more than 1 billion people there. more cars. So basically, the way of life in the United States and Western Europe cannot be duplicated around the world without a crunch on natural resources and without a terrible effect on the climate. And so that's kind of what's happening here. We're getting the beginnings of shortages. The companies are doing very well, of course. They're pumping this stuff out at fairly low cost and selling at a high price, but I don't think it's gouging in the classic sense of the word, anyway.
Mm. Well, you know, there's so many stories floating around right now. Number one, you hear, of course, that there's not enough refining capacity, that there are not enough of the ethanol additives to be added, and and of course, you hear the stories too coming from the oil companies. Hey, we're not making near as much money off of it as the governments are because of taxes. So the blame seems to be.
Well, the companies are doing extremely well. ExxonMobil is the largest company in the world. It's got the highest profits. I think its profits last year were $36 billion, beyond $300 billion in total turnover. I mean, these companies are making out like bandits, but they're situated in the midst of a shortage that is benefiting them. But I think just to be in the populist mode and denouncing the companies, I certainly am ready to denounce the companies for a lot of reasons, but that's not to really get to the heart of this matter. The heart of this matter is this stuff is running out, and anyway, it was extremely bad for the environment to burn it, and it's time to have a different energy system, a different transportation system, a different built environment, and we got to get going on these things. And all sorts of talk about excess profits, taxes, and so on are not going to take us any way towards that goal.
Well, it does seem as though we're ignoring, and I think the present administration, even more than any administration I can think of, is ignoring the big elephant in the room, and that is the fact that we are running out of oil, that we do have to come up with conservation methods until we can find alternative fuels. And it seems as though, and maybe I'm totally biased along these lines toward this administration, but it seems to be that virtually nothing is on the table for alternative fuel coming up with that or any significant conservation means in this country.
Well, that's right. The Bush administration has been particularly bad about this, but I think it's important to recognize that one administration after another, going right on, certainly Bill Clinton didn't do very much in this line either. And in fact, we recall the Kyoto Treaty, which was a very, very small step towards global coordination of efforts to reduce carbon emissions, was something that Clinton didn't even sign until his last day in office.
Right.
And he did it just as, giving the finger to George, but he didn't do a thing about it. And with Al Gore sitting there as his vice president, Al Gore wasn't very effective in spite of all of Al Gore's talk about the environment. So I think what we see here is, and now we bring the companies back into the picture, these companies are enormously influential. They, buy and sell members of Congress. They get what they want. And they also have a huge impact on the media. They have ads in the media all the time. And so they pretty much call the shots, and they've influenced the global the discussion. Public policy discussion tremendously.
Well, it seems that before we totally change over to whatever alternative fuel that may, whether it's hydrogen or whatever it is, ethanol or some sort of plant derivative that we can use for, especially for our vehicles, we're going to go through some phases, evidently. We're going to try and suck up every drop of oil that's on the planet, whether it whether it's the sandy oil from Canada or the shale from out west. Does that not seem that that's going to be where they're headed first before they really get to work on alternative energy?
Well, I think there's a lot of errors just waiting to happen as the next phase of energy policy. ethanol is not a good solution in the first place. It's a hydrocarbon. It gets burned. It puts the carbon burden into the atmosphere. It's not a good idea for that reason. It's usually put forward as a method for so-called energy independence so that the United States wouldn't have to import quite as much oil or transportation fuel from other countries. But this means this is food. And if you start taking the world's food and turning it into stuff to put in cars, you're pretty soon going to have a lot of worse famines than you do now.
Yes.
So it's a poor idea on that score. It's also likely to push all kinds of marginal fields into use and increase erosion. There's a lot of things that are wrong with this. And so ethanol is just not a very good direction to go in. Another thing that they're going to be doing is promoting nuclear energy for electricity. And possibly then for use with electric cars. And that's not, we know about the problems of nuclear energy. There's two main ones. One is that these things can melt down and it's hard to know what to do with the contaminated plants after you finish with them, because they don't last for very long. They last for about 30 or 40 years, and that's it. And also, nuclear energy is connected to nuclear weapons, and the more nuclear energy you have around the world, you can't just start building nuclear plants in the United States. Everyone's going to want this stuff.
Well, you've mentioned a problem with almost every kind of energy so far. What do you think? Where do you think we should head with this?
Well, there are at least two pretty obvious energy sources. One of them is wind, and wind actually produces electricity at a rate that's lower than any other type of electrical production right now. So we should be building wind mills and wind farms like crazy. It's a very, very good technology.
But if we do that, then we've got Donald Trump and Ted Kennedy complaining about these oil, big wind off their coast and ruin their view.
Well, there's a lot of places to put these things,
yes.
And not all of them are right in front of the view of the Kennedy family. I mean, it's pretty pathetic. I think, frankly, that those things look kind of pretty. I love to travel through the countryside in Europe and see those big things turning around. After all, we like old windmills. Why wouldn't we like the sight of a new windmill?
I agree.
Especially
I agree.
If you know it's giving us clean energy.
Yes.
So that's the wind side, and of course, if there's no wind, it doesn't produce energy. Unlike a coal-fired plant that's functioning the whole time. But if you have an electric grid, now it's possible we have grids that go a very, very big distance. It didn't used to be that you could carry electricity that far, but you can now. And so there's going to be wind somewhere, and you can bring all that wind-generated electricity together, and you've got a lot of electricity. In some European countries, they have quite a large proportion of their total electricity generated by wind. Denmark, for example, in particular, but Germany has built a lot of wind. UK is building wind. Spain has a lot of windy shores where they're putting them up, so this is a very interesting technology. Second one is solar cells, and that's solar panels. And that is not as economically interesting right now. That is to say, it costs much more to produce electricity. But the technology is moving pretty fast. And if there's a lot of money pumped into this area, I think we're going to see costs are going to go down, and it, too, is going to begin to come in under these other fuels. So those two are really interesting. But those two by themselves don't solve the question of automobile transportation and whether or not automobile transportation is itself sustainable. I kind of think that the automobile is a pretty unsustainable type of transportation. But you can take electricity and you can use it to generate, to create hydrogen, and you can create a hydrogen car, but I'm not sure that that's really where we can go over the long haul. The point is, we've got to use energy much more effectively and much less than we're doing now.
Well, you know, I've always been a firm believer that indeed necessity is the mother of invention, and I have complete faith that people now and in the future will come up with alternative methods of transportation of fuels that we need in this country and all. One of the big problems today seems to be is will this oil crisis cause some sort of a global political catastrophe? In the meantime, will we end up being in terrible wars fighting over the last drop of oil?
Well, I think that's a very good question, because it sure seems like there's a lot of conflict that's centered on oil, important areas of oil reserves, and Iraq was an obvious case, Iran now. Sudan is another place where there's a lot of conflict over oil, and so on. Venezuela, you name it. Well, I think there's two problems, though, Guy. One of them is the problem of global climate change. And will there be a transition soon enough to prevent catastrophic climate change from making, life, if not impossible, at least extremely difficult on the planet. And in the last 5 years, scientists have been finding that the climate change has been going much faster than they originally had thought. And there's a tremendous amount of melt-off in the Arctic regions where the temperature has risen faster than in the temperate regions. And I think this is very dangerous. And the problem with your optimism about people of eventually figuring things out and coming up with new solutions is that there may be a very short time horizon for this. And it's not at all clear that the solutions are going to come fast enough, especially with the big oil companies and the coal companies and the automobile companies blocking public discussion of this, so that ordinary citizens can start to think about how the future's got to be and whether things like automobile transportation really can carry forward into the future, or in what form, and so on. So if you add together the danger of conflict and the danger of global climate change, you've got some pretty serious stuff out there.
Oh.
We all got to really pitch in and get going on this.
We do indeed. I live in an area that's very environmentally sensitive, both in rising waters from the shore and also the Everglades, not being far away from where we are right here right this moment. And one of the problems you just mentioned is going to be more difficult to people to live where we live right here right now, just strictly because of insurance very soon. Insurance rates because of global warming, because of the increased number of hurricanes, and it's going to be prohibitive to live here if some of these conditions continue, and it seems like they are picking up steam, just like you said. James, it's been wonderful having you along with us today. I appreciate your comments very much. I value your comments and your abilities in this field, and I do keep track of them and read what you write. And it's been a pleasure to have you on the program to further educate our listeners. We've got very intelligent and very inquisitive listeners on this program, and it's always a pleasure to have someone like you and someone from your organization on the program, and I thank you so very much.
Good to be with you. Take care.
Thank you. Yeah, it's a problem. It's a problem, and like you said, it goes far beyond the gouging of the oil companies and everything. Yes, they are getting tremendously rich, but we've got to buckle up and figure out what the heck we're going to do here now. Let's go back to the phone. Who do we have on the line right now?
You got Dave.
Hi, Dave.
I had wanted to ask a question of your guest today because he's got a lot of valid points, but to try to make the case that these corporate oil tycoons in and out of the White House making billions of dollars, mansions, corporate jet planes, limousines, and that has nothing to do with the price of oil. Is that what he'd have us to believe?
No. I had a conversation with him earlier today. No, he doesn't believe that. He just believes that is that's a side issue, that yes, it's happening, but it's going to happen anyway, and we're eventually going to have to figure out a way out of this. They're certainly not going to help us. Yes, he knows that the money is flowing, and it's just that he's a very practical man, and he's thinking ahead of, well, what are we going to do? Yeah,
he has some environmental concerns, which are certainly valid, but I've got to believe billions of dollars going into retirements and boards of directors and all the luxuries that they're taking, that's coming from the person who's paying at the pump. That's where that money's going.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. It most certainly is. They're going to get their share of it no matter what. That's a virtual certainty. They will always...
And your share and my share and everybody else's share.
That's exactly right. Exactly right. I don't know what we're going to do about that. I really don't. I wish I knew.
Well, you expose it every way you can, and that's what I think is going to be done. You know, make as many people aware as we can.
Yeah, that's all we can, and that's all we can do, and just we've got to get people thinking and thinking and thinking about this. And, you know, right now I think conservation is so terribly important, and I think America is aware of it, and we're going to have to be a lot more aware of it in the future. So, wow. I don't know what's going to happen.
Thank you for everything, Guy. Were you able to reschedule Clint or Brad?
Yeah, very soon. Very soon. Probably next week.
Okay.
So we'll have that to look forward to. Got a lot more to talk to him about, believe me.
Yes, indeed. That's got to be our hope, you know.
Yeah, you know, I'm trying to figure out a way, and I think I have, that we could try and just have him on for like at least an hour, maybe an hour and a half on the program, and really do it upright, because this definitely a subject that we could spend. that I needed to yet, trying to resolve the technical issues we've had. So we'll get at that as soon as we can.
Thank you for everything, Guy.
Thank you, Dave. Yeah, what are we doing? Yeah, are all of you in the same boat as I am? I had to go to the drugstore today, still fighting these allergies. Had to, you know, come home with a carload of tissue. Went to a specialist yesterday. And what does that mean anymore, you know? Went to an allergy specialist, my first allergy. So I go to the specialist, and they put this little sample of whatever might set off an allergy. They put it under your skin, and then they wait about 10 minutes to see if you are, in fact, allergic to it. And I don't know what all they stuck under my skin. Several things they mentioned, ragweed, this, that, and the other, and samples of it. And then they come back and measure the spot. And by golly, they find out that you are allergic to something. So they give you this medicine that says, hey, this is a surefire cure for this. And they give you a shot. And then go to the drugstore and get your prescription and pay through the nose for it. And then you think, well, and they say, well, this is going to take care of that for you, so don't you worry. Not yet, it hasn't. But we're going to keep fighting it and trying to stay in as good. You know, the worst part about it is, and I was starting to talk like an old lady here, the hypochondriac, when I've talked about this lately. I'm trying to kill a minute here before the news at the top of the hour. The worst thing is the lack of sleep. Oh, you know, I know lots of you have written and said you've suffered from terrible sinus problems and so forth, and I don't know how you sleep if your head's stuffed up. I couldn't sleep for a second that way. I mean, never. And so you get your head all unstuffed and everything, lay down in the pillow and go to sleep, and you're asleep about 30 minutes, and next thing you know, you're awake and going, oh, my God, and here it comes back again. So a good night's sleep would be something. So I hope you understand. If I sound a little bit morose or a little lackadaisical a little later on the program today, at least you'll understand why. I don't know. But we're glad to have you along with us today, and we're going to have a good interview coming up in just a few minutes, and stick with us. We'll be back after the news.
In Washington, the federal government released a plan to deal with a possible avian flu epidemic, which would disrupt the nation for months and have the impact of a terrorist attack or major hurricane. The Bush administration warns that cities and businesses should not count on the federal government to rescue them. In Washington, a multi-billion-dollar supplemental spending bill goes before the Senate for a full vote today. The $108 billion bill would fund the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and provide Hurricane Katrina relief. Also on Capitol Hill, congressional Republicans have reached a tentative agreement on a $70 billion tax relief package. The plan extends tax cuts on dividends and capital gains. The president wants the tax cuts to be permanent, saying they're the reason for the country's economic growth. Also in the House, lawmakers approved a bill that would impose civil and criminal penalties on energy companies that are accused of price gouging. However, it will be up to the Federal Trade Commission to define that term. Near Russia's Black Sea coast, an Armenian passenger plane has crashed, killing all 113 people aboard. The plane was attempted to land in stormy weather when it went down. The UN Security Council today will introduce a draft resolution from the U.S., Britain, and France to convince Iran to abandon its nuclear ambitions. Today, Iran announced it had enriched enough uranium now to fuel nuclear reactors. In Iraq, at least 18 people were killed, mostly Iraqi police recruits, and 30 were wounded when a suicide bomber blew himself up at a Fallujah police station. Iraq's parliament convened for the third time since the December elections. In southern Afghanistan, the New York Times reports that the Taliban insurgency is growing. After the winter, the fighting season resumes, but this year, the militants are reportedly stronger in greater numbers and more brazen in their violent attacks. In Nigeria, U.S. diplomats are pressuring the Sudanese government for concessions to reach a peace deal with rebels. The civil war in the Darfur region in the past 3 years has killed tens of thousands and left 2 million people homeless. Television commentator Louis Rukeyser has died of cancer at age 73, and Earl Woods, the father of golfing legend Tiger Woods, has died at 74. This is the Quality News Network.
Divorce is never a pleasant experience, but it doesn't have to be a tragedy. If you can rein in the emotions, step back from the anger and victimhood, you can end your marriage with dignity instead of hostility. You married with the best of intentions. Now you need to untie the marital knot with the same mutual respect. Choose collaboration instead of confrontation. Stop wasting money on lawyers. Don't drag this out for 5 years. A collaborative divorce is better for the children, family, and friends. Collaboration costs a fraction of a contended divorce and can be done within weeks rather than the months or years. An award-winning documentary called Divorce Collaborative Style explains how you can end your marriage fairly and efficiently. For less than what a lawyer charges to answer one simple question, you can get all the answers from Divorce Collaborative Style. Go to collaborativedivorce.tv and order your DVD today. If it's over, end it right. collaborativedivorce.tv.
The U.S. Postal Service is asking for another rate hike of 3 cents for the spring of 2007. That would raise the price of a first-class postage stamp to 42 cents. Sales of Asian cars now make up 39.5% of the U.S. market. European automakers increased their American sales to 7%. For the first time in U.S. automotive history, Toyota has become the number 3 car seller in the nation. Toyota outsold Daimler Chrysler in April. Congressional Republicans have dropped their plan for a $100 rebate for most Americans to make up for high gas prices. The GOP was accused of political pandering in this election year. A study shows that if stay-at-home moms were to be compensated for all the work they do, they should be earning more than $134,000 a year. The survey by Salary.com estimates that housemakers spend nearly 92 hours weekly doing those household tasks. U.S. gasoline supplies have risen this week, according to a newly released government report. It's the first jump in the nation's gas supply in 9 weeks. And that news brought down the price of oil. Light sweet crude settled at $72.28 a barrel today. And at Wall Street at this hour, the Dow Jones is down 16 points, the NASDAQ down 6 points, the S&P 500 down 5 points. There's more at QualityNewsNetwork.com. I'm Ali Dramoff. It's now 5 minutes past the hour.
What your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country.
I have a dream.
This is the Guy James Show. The Guy James Show, America's number one Democratic talk show. You've heard from the radical right. Now, all that's left is the truth. And now here's Guy James.
Yes, Guy James here with you. Glad to be back here with you this afternoon. We're going to have our guest on in just one moment. Thanks for sitting in and listening to the program this afternoon. As promised, we're going to have Lawrence Corborn, and I think we've got him on the phone right now. We got finally got through there. I had little difficulties during the time. Lawrence, are you with us? Hello?
Hello?
Yes. Glad to have you with us.
Hi,
this afternoon. Very good. Glad to have you along with us this afternoon.
Glad
on the program. Never fails me. I'm alone in the studio today trying to run all the buttons, and sooner or later I screw something up. So, as I mentioned, Lawrence Korb is a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, and we love having people on from the center because we always get some meaty information, and he and Brian Katulis have come out with their strategic redeployment progressive strategy for Iraq, And I know that's something that's obviously, according to the polls, first and foremost in everyone's mind right now politically. What do you think? Where are we at on the Iraq war right now? Are we mired in so deep that we're going to be there for years, or do you think you've come up with a viable plan to get us out of there?
Well, we think we've come up with a viable plan that makes the best of a bad situation. You know, it's going to be difficult for this administration to implement it unless, you know, they get pressure from the Congress and from the, you know, from the people. The Congress took a step last year when they basically said 2006 should be the year of transition. Okay, well, you know, nothing has really really changed. But we argued back last September that what the United States needs to do is set a deadline to leave, because as long as we're there, the Iraqi government and the Iraqi security forces will lean on us as a crutch. If you stay through the end of 2007, that will mean that you're there almost 5 years, which is really time enough for them to get their act together. It'll also diffuse part of the insurgency, because, you know, we have the impression that many of the, you know, the insurgents are mainly foreigners. They're mostly Iraqis who just don't want us there. They're making common cause with the people from outside. But once we go, they'll have no reason to, to be fighting. So we really feel that's the best thing to do. And, you know, it'll also increase our security, because things are not going well in Afghanistan. You need more troops there. You can't get them. You got a looming problem with Iran, which is not much you can do as long as you're mired in Iraq. Your National Guard needs to get home to, you know, provide homeland security, as we saw with Katrina. You know, heaven help us if we had a man-made terrorist attack. The Guard would not be here. And your all-volunteer army, the quality is really starting to decline. And the longer you stay, the worse it's going to get.
Well, interesting enough, since you mentioned that, I saw Ted Kennedy last night being interviewed, and he was asked point blank, do you think we're going to have a draft come back? And Ted Kennedy said, well, you know, that's something we'll have to consider, which in political terms usually means yes. I don't know. Do you think that's something that's going to come back in the future?
You know, the question really for the government and the people is to decide how low a quality, particularly army, are you willing to accept to defend the nation? Because if you can't get people to volunteer because if it's an unpopular war and you decide to continue it, are you going to have to do something else? Nobody wants a draft. But, you know, in the 2000 campaign when Bush said, I'll never have a draft, you can't say that. I mean,
right.
You can say, I'd prefer not to have a draft, but, you know, for example, one out of every six people coming into the Army this year gets a waiver. You know, in other words, they're not meeting the qualification.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you know, familiar with, you know, military ranks, but so many officers are leaving after their first tour that 97% of the captains, that's the third level, got promoted to major this year. Normally it's about 60%.
Wow.
So that means in the future, you're going to have people, not the best people out there, you know, in very responsible positions, because a lot of the other people, they've left after they've completed their obligated service.
Isn't it true that the average American has the mistaken impression that we don't need a lot of troops with the great level of technology that we have? We can push a button here and there and win a war. Don't you think that particular attitude has taken over a lot of the American public?
Well, and I think it's taken over Don Rumsfeld, too, in the Defense Department, because, you know, they had this idea with all this technology, we can sort of win these wars, you know, with three men and a small boy, you know, and all this, you know, high technology. But what we've seen is, in order to secure the victory or secure the peace, when you have a regime change like we had in Iraq, you need boots on the ground. You need numbers. Numbers are important. And that's why the Army Chief of Staff, General Shinseki, before the war said, you know, you need several hundred thousand, not 130,000. We now know that Colin Powell, who, remember, has General Powell, when, you know, told Bush, you know, you didn't have enough troops.
Right, right. Well, we mentioned opening the program today about where we were during the Second World War at this particular same mm-hmm. point in time that we're at right now. We'd equipped millions of people, built ungodly numbers of ships and tanks and I don't know what all, and made sure that our troops had everything they needed. And here we are 3 years later in this war, And we by no means achieved any sense of having the best army that we could have equipment-wise anyway. Rumsfeld, I don't know. It seems to me that Rumsfeld just totally blew off the generals of what they wanted to do in this war and did it on his own.
He basically felt that those arguing for large numbers of troops on the ground were doing that mainly to maintain a large military, large army, and he was trying to get a smaller army, you know, make it more agile, more lethal, and as you mentioned early on, you know, taking advantage of this technology rather than numbers. And so, yes, he ignored them. He thought, well, they're just trying to, you know, save the army or keep me from cutting down the size of the army, when in fact, you know, General Shinseki had been through Vietnam. In fact, he lost his foot there, and he commanded the peacekeeping in Bosnia, you know,
yes.
and he knew what it would take with boots on the ground. And if you go back and you look, you know, Germany in the post-war occupation, they had the population then of West Germany was not much bigger than Iraq, you know, at the time. We had
right.
a million troops there.
Right.
You know how many casualties we had in the occupation? None.
None. None. Yes, amazing difference. I have maintained all along, and I'm certainly not alone. There are probably millions of people thought the same thing, that our diplomacy leading up to this war, and probably the one that may happen in Iran, our diplomacy has been almost totally lacking, and that the reason for that has come directly out of the White House. It just seems like we've had no real diplomatic efforts whatsoever, and nor are we conducting any right now with Iran. Do you see it that way?
Yeah, in fact, it's very interesting. You know, Colin Powell, a person I have a great deal of admiration for, I worked with him for 3 years in the Reagan administration. You know, basically, when he came in as Secretary of State, he said, you know, I think we ought to continue the Clinton policy of negotiating with North Korea. Bush said no. Okay? I think we ought to pick up on the negotiations with Iran, particularly after the Iranians helped us in Afghanistan. They said no. Somehow or another, Bush and Cheney and the people they listen to think that negotiating is some sort of sign of weakness. And, you know, look at who we've negotiated with. You know, the Soviet Union, China. When I was in government, you know, I got sent over to China to help them modernize their logistics system, because we wanted them as a counterweight to the, you know, the Soviet Union. And, you know, they were certainly not, you know, Democrats at the time.
No, and look how many years, you know, I give Richard Nixon his due. Look mm-hmm. how many years that the world, and at least our section of the world, wanted to pretend that China didn't exist.
Yeah.
And we just let that go. Thank God Nixon was smart enough to get people over there and get some dialogue going. And
right.
And we're in the same position right now with the Middle East.
This is the first administration that's not been heavily engaged in the situation between Israel and Palestine, right? We're the only ones that can really make progress. We've got credibility with both sides. I mean, Henry Kissinger, George Shultz, you know, Madeleine Albright spent a lot of time there. You know, Powell wanted to, and they just said, no, let's stay out of it. And, you know, to people in the Muslim world, that's a very important issue. And it's not a question of siding, you know, with a side or another. It's being involved to try and help the situation.
Well, where does Condi Rice stand in all of this? Is it known around Washington that she would like to actually have some real diplomacy with Iran and try and talk this out? Or is she being ignored like Powell was?
Well, I think she's not being ignored like Powell was, but I think she tells Bush what he wants to hear. And, you know, if you go back and look when she was the national security advisor, you know, she basically, you know, should have told the president, look, you know, you're going into Iraq, and, you know, Rumsfeld says, you know, you're not going to need many troops, you know, but Powell, he knows a little bit about that. Shinseki, you ought to look to them. And she didn't. I mean, that was her job then. To basically say, look, you know, obviously Rumsfeld has a point of view, and there's nothing wrong with that, but, you know, my job is to make sure that you understand that that's not the only, you know, thing. And how in heaven's name any president of the United States would not pay attention to a man with Colin Powell's background, both in military and diplomatic? Remember, Colin had also been the National Security Advisor.
Absolutely.
In addition to Secretary of State and Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff.
Absolutely. I I felt so bad at the time. I had a great deal of respect for Colin Powell, and I'm afraid I've lost some of it.
I think history will not treat Colin as well as they should because of this. You know, the speech he gave to the United Nations and basically not doing what Cyrus Vance did under Jimmy Carter when Carter, you know, had the mission to rescue the hostages in Iran. He said, you know, I think this is the wrong thing. It's not going to work. But, you know, you're the president, and so as soon as it's over, I'm out of here.
Well, you're an interesting guy to talk to because I can ask you this question, and a lot of people wouldn't have an answer for it, but I think you might. What would Reagan have done?
Well, here's what Reagan would have done, and we've got some evidence. First of all, if he was going to go to Iraq, he would have gone in big. I saw him, history is documented, you know, when we went into Grenada, for example, the military said, you know, we can go in with X troops. He said, well, why don't you send X plus, just in case?
Mm-hmm.
Okay? But, you know, whereas Bush and Rumsfeld asked the military what you need, and then they cut it in half, he would have doubled it. The other thing was that I think he would have recognized when the policy wasn't working and would have changed. You know, in Lebanon, we had a horrible situation in October of 1983. And what happened, within 2 months, Reagan, we had a report on what went wrong. Reagan walked out into the White House press room because the report had said to blame some underlings. You know, he said, no, I'm commander-in-chief. I sent them. It's my fault, and I'm going to do something about it. Within 3 months, we were out of there.
Yes. Well, that's always a real man that'll stand up and...
You have to be... You know, look, the American people know none of us are perfect. And we all make mistakes. What they don't want is not to change the course. And that's what we've been trying to do here. Okay, let's not talk about, you know, why we went there and all. We're there. Now what do you do in order to safeguard American security? And our plan says you don't leave the region altogether because people say, well, what will you do if it collapses or becomes another haven for terrorists? We keep an army division in Kuwait. We've had troops in Kuwait ever since the first Persian Gulf War, put the Marines on ships, bring, as we say, over the horizon with a carrier battle group. Believe me, that would be enough to handle anything that might happen.
Yes, yes. I think the one thing that, a lot of things, being the partisan Democrat that I am, but the other night at the National Press Dinner there when the comedian got going on George Bush, the most appropriate thing I think he said was that he's... he made reference to him not changing his mind. He said, I like the fact that he doesn't change his mind. If he believes it on Monday, he believes it on Wednesday, no matter what happened on Tuesday. And I just see this stay the course thing is it appears to me that the president thinks history is going to absolve him of this somehow. And I don't know what kind of a miracle he must be praying for.
Well, he mistakes stubbornness for principle. Okay? In other words, that, you know, by being stubborn, do you show your person a principle? No. You know, when things change, you've got to admit that it's a different situation and deal with it. I mean, we would all like the world to be the way we want it to be, but a lot of times it isn't.
Absolutely.
And, you know, and it's an interesting thing. I don't know if you have children or, you know, and people come and tell you things, you know, gee, you got to watch your child. They've done this or that. You say, oh, it's not my child. You know, we don't like to hear bad news, you see, but you have to look at it as it is and deal with it. And I think part of the problem is, you know, nobody walks into the Oval Office and says, look, you know, this is terrible. George Shultz, a couple of times, walked into Reagan, and the Secretary of State, said, look, you don't want to negotiate with the Soviets, I'm out of here.
Mm.
Yeah, Reagan said, well, no, you better stay, you know, and he began to talk to the Soviets and, you know, completed a couple of good arms deals with them.
And let's face it, I mean, it takes guts to go in and talk to the chief executive.
Oh, yeah. Let me tell you, I was only a sub-cabinet officer, but I've seen a lot of people say, oh, I can't wait till I get in there, you know. You get in, boy, the trappings in the Oval Office and stuff, and you're almost speechless.
Well, it has been said aplenty that this group, the Project for a New American Century group, that... are extremists, and I differentiate on this program many times these people and Republicans. because I don't see these people, this current group, as real Republicans. And I can't see this group having had sway over Ronald Reagan. They did not have sway over Bush 1, I don't think.
No. In fact, Brent Scowcroft, who was National Security Advisor both to President Ford and to the first President Bush, I mean, he tried to warn these people about going into Iraq, and he got so frustrated that they wouldn't listen to him that he wrote an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal, and then he just gave an interview to the New Yorker, basically said, you know, I don't thought I knew Dick Cheney. I don't know him anymore. You're like, where are these guys coming from?
Yeah.
And what has happened is, you know, if you go back and you look at the history of the Republican Party, in 1952, Eisenhower didn't want to run. You know, he wasn't into the politics thing and all that. And he told then-Senator Taft from Ohio, look, if you'll support NATO and the United Nations, I won't run. And Taft said no. So he came in, and the Republican Party from Eisenhower through Bush, the first President Bush, were really multilateralist, realist about using military force. You know, they tried to get Eisenhower to bail the French out at the NBN Fu in 1954, and he said no. He came in and, you know, he wound down to Korea and he got a truce in Korea. He wasn't, you know, listening to MacArthur, you know, and trying to conquer China, you know. And as you mentioned, Nixon got us out of Vietnam, started relations with China. Bush 41, if you read his book, he said people wanted me after I threw the Iraqis out of Kuwait to go to Baghdad. It had been a mess. I'd have been, you know, what would I have done? And you read that and you say, this is exactly what happened.
Right. You made the right decision. And of course, Colin Powell was in on it. I don't know. I have to wonder just what happened along the way here. I think just we got the...
Well, I think a combination as the so-called neocons were in powers of position, in positions of power. You had September 11th, and I think it was easy for them to convince, you know, President Bush to take on this very idealistic, you know, foreign policy that's devoid of realism. But you go back and remember the 2000 campaign. He said, I want to have a humble foreign policy. He accused Gore of overreach and doing that nation building
right.
in Bosnia. Remember?
Right. Nation, yeah. Accused Gore of doing nation building. And we have done nation building for 3 years now, or at least tried
yeah,
it.
Yeah.
I don't think we've done any actual building. But
no, and in fact, we haven't. We got, in fact, one of the things we point out in our plan, you got to get away from nation building. You got to get, you know, reconciliation and a peace. You know,
yes.
Internal security first before you can do anything.
Most certainly. I want to thank you so much for being on the program today.
Everybody can
go and read your latest report at I got this right, AmericanProgress.org, right?
Right. Yeah, we put up our report today. It went up, and Senator Feinstein had a press conference this afternoon promoting it, and so it's up there.
It's very good reading. Everybody can understand it easily and get the gist of it and understand where we ought to be going in this situation. Lawrence Korb, thank you so much for being on the
sure
program
thing.
Today.
Anytime.
Thank you.
Okay, bye.
Bye now. Yeah, there's a guy that knows what we ought to be doing. A very sensible plan. I call it a kind of the middle-of-the-road plan. There are those of us right now that would love to just... send the boats over and the planes over and bring every one of our soldiers home, have them out of there by midnight tonight. And probably militarily, that's probably not a wise thing. That's at first blush something that we, many of us anyway, would think about doing. I've said that myself. But they've got a very good plan, and there's a man there's a former official in the Reagan administration talking about what this administration has done so terribly wrong. And we know that. And we're hearing that from sensible Republicans. You know how partisan I am, and I know so many of you are as well. We're dyed-in-the-wool, yellow-dog Democrats, progressives, whatever you want to call us. But there have been times when Republicans have, you know, been sensible. And I've said for a long time that this gang in power right now are not Republicans. They are not Republicans. They are something other, something completely other. And I know that at least Reagan and Bush 1 totally recognized that because they had some dealings with these PNAC boys and wanted nothing to do with them. So it's amazing to me that they did capture the hearts and minds of the Republican Party, though, and they did it in such an efficient way by swaying the evangelicals, for example. They got them completely away from talking about matters of war and the military and so forth, and got them talking about, once again, the family values and gay marriage and abortion. Isn't it something that these warmongering bastards who are running the country right now ran twice now and never talked about the real issues? They went off on a tangent and got the voters to go along with them. Oh, we're going to work on abortion. We're going to work on this and that and family values. Family values. We're wonderful family people. And it was all nothing but malarkey. And all of us know that now. And I hope to God that the evangelical movement that so willingly went along with these people and definitely put them over the edge into office, I hope these people have understood what they have done. I hope they will understand what their assistance to this administration has done. And I hope they come to their senses next time around. And when somebody else like this runs for office again, somebody other than a Falwell or a Robertson or a Dobson or any of those people will stand up and say, hey, wait a minute. We've got to work for the good of our nation, not just one singular issue or two that we're after. We've got to work for this country. If you want to be true patriots that can truly wrap yourself in the flag and wave that flag proudly like so many of these people like to do nowadays, talk about patriotism when they're fake patriots, you work toward the good of all the people in this country. You forget for a moment your one issue or your two issues that you're tied into, that you are passionate about. You work for the issues that are good for all the people, and then we can hone in like a laser on your issue. A little speech I gave the other day, I told the people, you know, it's such in such simplistic terms. First, we've got to get somebody from our side driving the bus. And then we can all get on the bus and we can all get our issues taken care of. But first, we've got to get our people driving the bus. And I hope all of our Democratic friends will remember that. If you are a single-issue voter, please get off of that. Don't give up your issue. I'm not saying that at all. You know that. But please, for the good of the country, for the good of the party, let's work together this time around. Let's we Democrats get together and for once, work as a unit and get our people elected. It's so important to this country. It's not important to the Democratic Party. The parties aren't that important. It's the good of the whole country that we're after. And if the Democratic Party are the ones that lead this country to better things, then all that much better. So do keep that in mind. Hey, we're going to run off for a moment or two, and we'll be back. And we're going to talking about little issues that the Republicans always like to put in people's face to win elections. Here is one.
It's been 5 years since I've had a raise in pay. Way things are going, I could get laid off any day. Sure is hard living with all this pain. I know what I need. I need somebody to blame. Teenage immigrant welfare mothers on drugs.
It's all their fault.
Teenage immigrant welfare mothers on drugs.
They got some gold.
Teenage immigrant welfare mothers on drugs.
They got no class.
Teenage immigrant welfare mothers on drugs.
Let's send them back.
My neighborhood library is about to close. The school my kids go to is becoming a joke. Self-serving liberals blame it on corporate tax breaks. But that's propaganda. I know who I should hate.
Teenage immigrant welfare mothers on drugs.
It's all their fault.
Teenage immigrant welfare mothers on drugs.
They got some gold.
Teenage immigrant welfare mothers on drugs.
They got no class.
Teenage immigrant welfare mothers on drugs.
Let's send them back.
Who's to blame for the potholes and flooding and drought?
It's all their fault. It's all their fault.
Who's to blame for inflation, unemployment, and everything I'm pissed off about? Who's to blame for the end of the good old days? Who's to blame for the fact that I can't get laid?
Teenage immigrant welfare mothers on drugs.
It's all their fault.
Teenage immigrant welfare mothers on drugs.
They got some gold.
Teenage immigrant welfare mothers on drugs.
They got no class.
Teenage immigrant welfare mothers on drugs.
Let's send them back. Send them back. Send them back.
Teenage immigrant welfare mothers on drugs.
It's all their fault.
Teenage immigrant welfare mothers on drugs.
They got some gold.
Teenage immigrant welfare mothers on drugs.
It's a lie. If it's not fair and people die, we should have known better, but we got in too deep. We should have known better, but we let it all go. We should have known better, but we walk in our sleep. Are we never to remember the mistakes we repeat? What we sow is what we reap. Somebody tell me it's over, and this is only a dream. Somebody tell me it's over, things aren't as bad as they seem. What do you say to the family? Children lay in memories. Why wouldn't you listen when we march in the streets? Why wouldn't you listen when the world prayed for peace? You never had a feeling for the fathers and sons, but you couldn't wait for the inspectors to come. Or until your war had begun. Somebody tell me it's over, and this is all. Somebody tell me it's over. Things aren't as bad as they seem. Somebody tell me it's over. All the fear, the lies, and the schemes. You take that day in September, tear us apart at the seams. Somebody tell me it's over.
Oh, yeah, somebody tell me it's over. Glad to have you back with us. Interesting interviews today. I love talking to these boys on the inside, letting us know what how things have been. Now, there's a good, honest-to-God Republican that we just talked to there a moment ago, and straight up tell you that he thinks these people are a bunch of neocons that aren't real Republicans, so I don't know. Hey, I hope everything's going okay today, sound-wise. Everything's fine here in the studio. Everything's fine with our cable. If you are not getting the program, then, well, first of all, you won't hear me saying that. And secondly, that would definitely prove to me that we are having some sort of a hacking problem somewhere and hard to track down in some cases. I know people don't like what we say. I know people who have gone to great lengths to see that we're not on the air. I do recall that right after we went on the air where we're at here now, that the local Republicans vowed to get us off the air, and let me quote them, by any means necessary. So who knows what's at work here, but I do hope you're able to get the program. I can see from my little gauges here that there are quite a few people online, so I do hope you're hearing what I'm saying right now. Hey, somebody on Democratic Underground right now, post something on there and let me know, or else give us a call. 866-546-5254. 866-546-5254. This business that came up in the past few days about Bush breaking all these laws, what did they say, 750 times that he broke the law? 750 times that he went against what Congress had done and actually broke the law, but says since he's a president, he can break the law. What does it mean? And I've thought a lot about this the past couple of days. What does it mean when you declare yourself above the law? What does it mean? How is it that anyone under the Constitution of this nation can declare themselves above the law? Isn't it written in one of our sacred national documents that all men are created equal? I'm still looking for the part which says someone, anyone can be above the law. I've looked and looked and looked, and I can't see that. I can't even see where the president, the cowboy in chief, the top cowpoke, if George W. Bush wants to leak classified information that could endanger lives, he'll do it if he wants. He can eavesdrop on the peaceniks, you betcha, if he wants. And if he chooses to classify anti-war activists as terrorist sympathizer, that's what he's going to do. Why? Because he can. He's leader of the free world, so he gets to call the shots. His band of outlaws stole the 2000 election, fair and square, the way they see it. That gives him the right to do as he pleases. Doesn't matter if what he wants to do is immoral. He is, after all, the decider of morality. God told him so. And if what he wants to do is illegal, well, he'll just ignore the law. The rules don't apply to him. He says so. Sound preposterous? Think again. Just think again. Over the past 6 years, Bush has challenged more than 750 federal laws. Among them are the torture bans, the statutes mandating congressional oversight of presidential decisions, the Patriot Act provisions. And he's done this under his assertion, that the president has the right and the authority to bypass any law that disagrees with, quote, his interpretation of the Constitution. His interpretation of the Constitution. Of course, this declaration of his constitutional omnipotence was always done under the radar. And here's how they do it. After they sign a bill, once the media and the lawmakers and the guests had all gone home, he'd issue a signing statement, which are a set of instructions detailing how he wants this new law implemented. And in some instances, his instructions completely wipe out compromise provisions already agreed upon by both houses of Congress, yes. And unless senators and representatives actually regularly read the Federal Register, where news of presidential signing statements are published, and by the way, he's used those more than any president ever, these legislators are usually clueless about what he's done. He's actually done this in secret, and nobody's known it. We know it, and yet our legislators seem not to know it. And in a way, you've got to admire the cleverness involved here. if nothing else, the sheer audacity of the whole thing. You know, Bush spends a lot of his time stumping for a line on item veto when in truth he has already got it. He's the only chief executive since Thomas Jefferson to serve 6 years without ever officially vetoing a bill sent to him by Congress, because he uses another route to get around it. He doesn't need a light item veto. I don't know why he even brings it up that he wants it. You know, I don't know what he thinks the lawmakers are. Does he think they're dumb, impotent? What does he think? He's punked them, that's for sure. And to be perfectly truthful, the journalists aren't any wiser than the people in Congress. Mainstream media didn't catch on about this until a tiny little story about the White House, the National Security Agency, and the illegal but Junior Bush-approved domestic wiretapping scheme. It what brought this all out when he said he had unquestionable power to do whatever he wanted to do. We've mentioned it on this show for over 2 years now, but our warnings have fallen on deaf ears. I got this out of the Boston Globe right here. And let me quote the Boston Globe. Among the laws Bush said he can ignore are military rules and regulation, affirmative action provisions, requirements that Congress be told about immigration service problems, whistleblower protections for nuclear regulatory officials, and safeguards against political interference in federally funded research. Legal scholars say the scope and aggression, this is still from the Boston Globe, legal scholars say the scope and aggression of Bush's assertions that he can bypass laws represent a concerted effort to expand his power at the expense of Congress, upsetting the balance between the branches of government. The Constitution is clear in assigning to Congress the power to write the laws, and to the President a duty to take care that the laws be faithfully executed. Bush, however, has repeatedly declared that he does not need to execute a law he believes is unconstitutional. What I want to know is, who the hell gave George Bush, and I want somebody from his administration to spell it out to me, where's Gonzalez when you need him, the leading lawman in this country? He has a duty to go in front of the people of the United States and explain to us how George Bush thinks he does not need to execute a law that he thinks is unconstitutional. Who the hell does George Bush think he is? That alone is enough for an impeachment of a president right there. And did you hear today, yesterday, that the FBI director said he's got his allegiance to Bush and not to the people? Did you hear that? Jeez. You know, if, for my money, if you declare yourself to be above the law, by definition, nothing for you then is illegal. And surely that's the argument that this new White House Minister of Propaganda, Tony Snow, and the small, very small, remaining band of Bush loyalists will use to defend their boy against the inevitable criticism, and it's a fair point. If what Bush claims is true, he did not violate the letter of the law. Make no mistake, though, he surely is kicking the hell out of the spirit of the law in the interest of grabbing more and more and more power from the Congress and the courts for his own evil, sinister purposes. I want all of my Republican friends listening to the program right now, somebody tell me where it says in any document you can find, legal document you can find in this country now or ever written, where it says the President of the United States can decide what is constitutional and what is not. I want you to find a document for me and provide it that anybody, any one man, can decide what is constitutional and is what is not. Is that not what we have a Supreme Court of the United States for? to decide what is constitutional and what is not. Hell, get rid of them. Get rid of them. Take the Supreme Court building and store corn in it for all that matter, because it doesn't matter anymore, does it? Bush will decide what is constitutional and what is not. You don't need the Supreme Court when you have a Bush in office who can decide. This is the most absurd thing that has yet happened in his administration, and yet the American public is just walking along going, oh, well. Oh, well. I don't know. How would I know, a regular citizen, how would I know if the president can declare things constitutional or not himself? Oh, my God, people. You can't get White House legal staffers to even talk about this matter. I saw an interview with Phil Cooper, a Portland State University law professor who's very well known. He studied the executive power claims Bush made during his first term. Said Bush and his legal team have spent the last 5 years quietly working to concentrate ever more governmental power into the White House. Phil Cooper says there is no question that this administration has been involved in a very carefully thought out, systematic process of expanding presidential power at the expense of the other branches of government, Cooper said. This is a really big, very expansive, and very significant effort. He agrees to a compromise with the members of conference and Congress, and all of them are there for a public bill signing ceremony, but then he takes back those compromises, and more often than not, without the Congress or the press or the public knowing what has happened, said Christopher Kelly, a Miami University of Ohio political science professor who studies executive power. This is a terrible abuse of executive power. David Golub, a New York University law professor who specializes in executive power issues, said Bush has cast a cloud over the whole idea that there even is a rule of law, because no one can be certain of which laws Bush thinks are valid and which he thinks he can ignore. Where you have a president who is willing to declare vast quantities of the legislation that's passed during his term unconstitutional, it applies that he also thinks a very significant amount of the other laws that were already on the books before he became president are also unconstitutional. Jesus, can you understand the gravity of that statement? Bruce Fein, a guy we had on the show here a couple of weeks ago, Deputy Attorney General in the Reagan administration, said the American system of government relies upon the leaders of each branch to exercise some self-restraint. But Bush has declared himself the sole judge of his own powers, he said, and then ruled for himself every time. This is an attempt by the president to have the final word on his own constitutional powers, which eliminates the checks and balances that keep a country a democracy. And yet Bruce Fein told me that he would vote for Bush again if he ran for office. My God, I'm living in fantasy land, Alice in Wonderland. What does the unlimited executive power look like? Imagine Bush waking up tomorrow with the notion that the right to free speech and expression is unconstitutional. Maybe that's an over-the-top example, I know, but if the president can place himself or herself above the law at will, who's to say he or she will stop at some arbitrarily defined safe point? What happens if the commander-in-chief goes too far? What if, as many believe, he already has? If, as Bush contends, he can disobey laws as he sees fit, even if senators cry and moan about it, no meaningful checks or balances exist to protect the people from their supreme leader, not one. Can you say dictatorship? Because Bush has mentioned it three times since he's been president. Was it a Freudian slip? I think not. You know, along with many of you, I find this to be something out of a very bad fairy tale. How can it be that a nation who freed itself from the bonds of a king who, by the way, also thought he was omnipotent. How can it be that the people of this country who have lived and prospered under the Constitution of the United States for about 230 years, how can it be that we the people will allow this theft of power to take place right under our noses? How can it be that a significant number of our citizens, maybe around 30% or so, are still willing to trust a man who has time and again proven that he is infinitely untrustworthy? How can it be that we'll allow him to casually and callously rewrite the laws of the United States to suit himself and his accomplices? Do the people of this nation understand what's going on here? And if not, why not? If they don't understand what is going on here, there can only be a couple of reasons. First and most importantly, the American press has failed miserably in their responsibility to the people. They failed to print the truth. They failed in their jobs as watchdogs for the people to uncover and bring to the light of day the dirty little secrets of any government trying to circumvent the will of the people by violating the Constitution in any way they deem necessary. And Boyce is doing just that, and he's done it right under the nose of the press, and they've not said a word. Secondly, the people have failed as well. They failed in their duty to be good citizens and hold their elected officials accountable for their actions. The people are the ultimate judge and jury which decides whether or not the government is worthy of trust. And if the people find the government is not worthy of trust, then it is the people's responsibility to find that government guilty of crimes against the nation and sentence them to exile and shame. It is the people's sacred duty in this grand experiment that's been the United States of America to choose wisely those who are trusted with the keys to this kingdom. It's the people's right and the people's duty to make sure we have trustworthy men and women guiding the ship of state and being responsible caretakers of our Constitution and our Bill of Rights. If we the people can't hold up our end of that bargain, then we will ultimately become enslaved and owned by those who would like nothing more than to return to the days of kings and serfs. And guess who will be the serfs? You see, in a democracy, it's the people who have the ultimate power. It's the people who have the power to decide what's right and wrong for America. But if through apathy and laziness and misguided trust in the untrustworthy, we abdicate that power, then we will be the big losers. I know you've all read American history where the likes of Rockefellers and the Carnegies and the Mellons and the other almost royal families controlled most of the wealth and power in this country. And I'm also sure you've learned that ultimately the people wrested the power from these people through labor unions and civil rights. And when we did that, we enjoyed the fruits of our labor. We enjoyed the freedom we never quite had before. We enjoyed prosperity such as this nation had never experienced for the great masses. The great middle class was born, and America prospered like never before. It's true the rich were still rich, but the poor became much less poor, and the oppressed became less oppressed, and started to get an even break in our society. All of this happened because the people decided it would and should be so, and we made it happen. But now I see on the parts of many folks I know the willingness to just go along to get along. They know things are going the wrong direction. They know Junior Bush and his people are grabbing power at an alarming rate. They realize our jobs are disappearing before our very eyes. They see every day in the news that more and more of our people are losing their health care and their retirement benefits and being gouged by big business, while the rich and powerful are enjoying unprecedented wealth. And the answer of most people to this is, oh, well, there's nothing we can do about it. What if men like Walter Reuther and Samuel Gompers and Abe Lincoln and Franklin Roosevelt and Martin Luther King and other great American leaders had said, oh, well, there's nothing we can do about it. Where would we be now? Would we even be a nation now? I think the answer is no. We'd be under the control of somebody else, and most assuredly we would not be living under the Constitution of the United States of America. But these men did not say there's nothing we can do about it. They were leaders who would not take no for an answer. They were men of unshakable belief in themselves and the great American spirit. They had faith in the American people and our resolve as a nation. But times have changed. We've been at one of these crisis points before in our history, and we've always prevailed in a fashion that made America a greater nation than she was before whatever crisis she defeated. And we're at one of those times right now. Which direction will we take? Will we allow the forces of corruption and evil to take us over? Will the likes of Junior Bush and his people succeed in circumventing our Constitution and making the laws to suit themselves, therefore gaining unlimited power over the people? Or will we follow the examples of Lincoln and Gompers and Ruther and Roosevelt and the other great men who would have never stood for the antics of this present-day band of thieves and scoundrels? As I mentioned earlier in the program today, we would all do well to remember that Albert Einstein once said, "There are only two things that I believe are infinite: the universe and the stupidity of the American people, and I'm not sure about the universe." That's not very funny. Sorry to get preachy on you, but when I started reading that and digging into it about him breaking these laws and saying, well, it was up to him to decide, it was more than I could take. It ought to be more than you could take. It ought to be more than any American with any sense could take. I don't care if it had been Franklin Roosevelt. I don't care if it had been Harry Truman. I don't care if it had been John Kennedy. I don't care if it had been Jimmy Carter, Bill Clinton. I don't care if any Democrat in history would have ever said that he broke 750 laws and did it because he thought the laws were unconstitutional himself. I would say shame on him. And I say it's the ultimate shame on this presidency and the people who put him in office and keep him in office. He disgusts me. Sorry to get so serious with you, but that had to be said. I thank you for joining us today on the Guy James Show. I do enjoy talking to you every day. I appreciate your listenership. And I do appreciate all the kind remarks you make in your emails. I do hope you remember what we've said here in the last few minutes and take it to heart and find out all you can about it. One thing for damn sure, we're going to do all we can to change it. You heard from the radical right. Now all that's left is the truth. See you tomorrow, folks.